You are listening to a sermon by Derek Carr, recorded on Sunday, January 15, 2017, at the Plant Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you, Evan, for inviting me again. I can only presume that you are all serious gluttons for punishment. My talk, I think we'll call it a talk, not a sermon, this morning is listed in your sheet of paper, what you call it, the bulletin. Who on earth was Saint Kukufate? And why do we have saints anyway? Well then, about 15 miles west of my hometown in northeastern England, in the valley of the River Tees, which flows down from the Pennine Hills, there's a little village called Romaldkirk. The kirk, or church, dates back to early medieval times, and it still has some Anglo-Saxon stonework amid its walls, very old. And at some point in the first 21 years of my existence, before I came to Vancouver, I remember checking up on this mysterious Saint Romald, not to much avail, as it turned out, except finding that his name was probably Romuald, not Romald, but Romuald. And if you look him up in Wikipedia, you don't get much further than that, beyond changing the spelling of his name to Romvold. And they describe him in the most informative manner as a little-known Saxon saint. Very helpful. Relatives of a favourite aunt of mine lived in a little village on the Welsh border, on the English side of the Welsh border. Now, being the odd language that it is, English pronounces the name that looks as though it should be Leonard as Leonard. And working on that principle, the village on the Welsh border in which my aunt's relatives lived looks as though it should be called St. Weonards. But is it in fact St. Wonards, in spite of the fact that there's an E in there somewhere? And who on earth was St. Wonard? Well, go off to Wikipedia again, and it tells us that, are you ready? He may have been a local Celtic saint. Once again, very helpful. About Saint Kukufate, however, we do have a fair amount of information. And how did I come across him in the first place? Well, in the mid-1980s, when, for my sins, I was still head of Hispanic and Italian studies at UBC, and before we'd all become hideously computerized, I actually received an envelope via campus mail. Does that happen very often these days? I received an envelope via campus mail from the Museum of Anthropology. It contained a covering note asking for information and an opinion about a sheet of paper they had received from the supposed parish priest of a village supposedly called San Cucufate de Llanera, somewhere in northern Spain. The parish priest identified himself in this note as Father Juan Garcia. Now, that's almost like calling yourself John Smith in English. From what he'd written, he was obviously an amateur archaeologist, and he'd been rummaging about the ancient Celtic hilltop forts in northern Spain. Until the invention of satellite photography, many of these hilltop sites in the north of Spain were totally undocumented. Ramblers, hikers, and amateur archaeologists kept stumbling across them, sort of almost by accident. And apparently, on one of his outings, he'd unearthed an ancient Celtic axe head, which, he said, was about 4,000 years old, And on the big long sheet of paper that the Museum of Anthropology had received, there was in fact a Xerox copied image of this axe head. Now, this was not taken from a photograph, but it actually plonked the axe head on the Xerox machine and copied it that way. Quite an impressive object. It was probably about yay long and had what looked like a sharp axe end and then something which was more like a sort of pick point at the other end. Anyway, what he was trying to do, of course, was to peddle it off to North American museums. This was totally illegal from a Spanish perspective, since all such finds became automatically the property of the local provincial government in Spain. But as he pointed out in his covering note, the local museum already had plenty of these, so why not? In addition to this Xeroxed axe head, the covering note was written in three languages, Spanish, obviously, and then very elegant and very correct Latin, believe it or not, and then something that purported to be English. Unfortunately, I don't have the copy any longer. I'm not quite sure why, but I wish I could have read the whole thing at you. But it was signed in the English version by the Reverend Juan García, the parson, okay, translating the Spanish cura, which means parish priest. So he's using a very antiquated Anglican term, which I think people would find rather amusing. And it ended with the command, "Give me your telephone." Not your number. Give me your telephone. We shall treat the price. And a footnote to the Spanish version of the letter said that if we could not reply within a month, we should ignore it altogether, as I may no longer be here. Was his bishop onto him? Now, at first, as I'm sure you can imagine, I thought this was a big con job. And I think the Museum of Anthropology was a bit suspicious of it too. But I took out my Michelin map of Spain in the days long before Google existed, and I discovered that there is in fact a village called San Cucufate de Llanera in Asturias, in the very north of Spain, in the Cantabrian Mountains. These mountains are a sort of continuation of the Pyrenees, and they run right along the north coast of Spain as far as Santiago de Compostela, that medieval and modern place of fashionable pilgrimage. And since Asturias borders on the Basque country, and since García is in fact a Basque name, I thought that, well, perhaps Father John Smith, or Juan García, is a real person after all. And I was just lately looking up some details about the village, San Cucufate de Llanera, and it's got quite an extensive website, as it turns out, as do most places in Spain these days. And one of the people, who I think is the equivalent of the mayor, except that being a village, they wouldn't actually have a mayor, but he's actually called Juan Manuel García García. So actually, everybody's probably called García there. It's such a common local name. So he turned out to be sort of a real man anyway. And of course, my interest in Romance linguistics, in which subject you can fiddle about with sound shifts, made me realize that this San Cucufate was most likely the same saint who gave his name to the village and monastery of San Cugat del Vallès in Catalonia, just north of Barcelona. And so, who on earth was he anyway? Well, he appears to have been a saint and martyr of the very early church, born in North Africa. His official name was Saint Cucufas, which suggests to me a sort of Hellenistic background. He seems to have come from Carthage and had been sent with a Saint Felix. And I say a Saint Felix because I don't think it's the best known Saint Felix, who may have been his brother. He was sent from Carthage to evangelize the area around what is now Barcelona, where apparently he ministered to the homeless and the destitute people. And he was martyred for the faith in the year 304 AD, Anno Domini, his throat slashed by Roman soldiers under the orders of the Emperor Diocletian. And the Benedictine Abbey of Sant Cugat del Vallès in Catalonia, north of Barcelona, is reputed to be the site of his martyrdom. And that's about it as far as facts are concerned, except that, as usual, strange traditions abound. Places as far away as Germany, northern France, and Portugal, as well, of course, Spain itself, claim to have relics of this saint. And in the popular tradition of Spain especially, he was regarded as the patron saint, not of lost causes, but of lost objects. The popular rhyming folk prayer for his help in the recovery of lost watches and purses and car keys and so on is, however, a little vulgar. So I will not repeat it here. If you want some information in secret later, I'll pass it along. So I think the second part of my talk is, why do we have saints anyway? And in the Catholic and the Orthodox, and to a certain extent in the very early Anglican tradition, official canonization was a way of recognizing people whose lives had been distinguished by their exemplary holiness. And of course, this is what saint means from the Latin sanctus, holy. In the very early days of the Christian Church, saints were those who'd been martyred for the faith. But eventually, after Christianity became the established religion of the Roman Empire and martyrdom became somewhat less frequent, sainthood was conferred on those whose lives were regarded as outstanding examples of holiness and dedication to the cause. Initially, the process of canonization was conducted by the bishop of the diocese in which the holy person was martyred. And this explains why in Europe, Western Europe, you come across little villages with churches dedicated to saints about whom you've never heard anything in modern days. This is particularly true in Celtic Britain, Scotland, Wales and Ireland, but not just there, also in the part of, in England, which came under Anglo-Saxon rule and then subsequently Norman rule. But you find it in Italy and France and Spain as well. References to saints who simply do not figure in the modern canon, official canon of saints, and they were never officially recognised by the organised, the official church. It was a very much a local event. By about the year 1000, a very complicated legal process was developed in the canon law of the Western Church. And this reserved the final decree of canonization to the Pope. And if you didn't get that far, then you were not officially a saint. The Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church, has also its own process, but it's much less complicated than the Western variety, which is very, very legalistic. The initial process towards canonization of someone who's recognized as being exemplarily, if that's the word, very, very holy, is an official pronouncement by the Church that the person under scrutiny is actually in heaven. This is what beatification means. They are beatified, they are recognized as holy and having achieved entrance to paradise. The next step towards canonization to become officially a saint requires the confirmation that two miracles, usually nowadays inexplicable medical cures, can be attributed to the intercession of the individual concerned. And if the devil's advocate, that is an official investigator appointed by the Pope to look into possible impediments, If the devil's advocate can't find any impediments, then the cause will proceed to canonization, that is, the official recognition of the individual's exemplary holiness and, by extension, salvation. All well and good. But the next step is the one that became a bone of contention during and after the Reformation, and even actually long before that, and that is the veneration of saints by the faithful. Can we, as sinners by definition, communicate directly with the Lord our God, or do we do it indirectly through prayers to the Virgin Mary and all the saints to intercede on our behalf? And I think it's recognized now that there's a sort of latent Arianism lurking behind all this, the idea that our spirits are constrained by the flesh and that we need advocates. But this is still a bone of contention within the Western Christian Church in general. And by the Western Christian Church, I don't mean simply the Catholic Church, but Western Christianity altogether. Where do saints fit into all this? Can't we simply talk to God directly? Do we have to go through mediators? And of course, the Church has had to draw a very clear line between adoration, which we reserve for God, and veneration, that is, holy admiration, if you like, which we give to saints. Because popular obsession with certain saints has, over the centuries, come very close to displacing God from the centre of attention. And the other problem, as I see it at least, is that behind the canonisation of saints lurks the issue of politics. For example, in the year 2000, the Patriarch of Moscow canonised Tsar Nicholas, Tsarina Alexandra and their five children. Icons of them with halos around their heads are now available. And the canonization by the Catholic Church in 2002 of Monsignor José María de Escrivá, the founder of the Opus Dei movement in Franco's Spain, is a bit of an issue as well. The Opus Dei came to be regarded as a sort of secret Catholic Freemasonry, which you had to belong to if you wanted to get anywhere in your professional life in Franco's Spain. And I can tell you a couple of jokes about that, if you like. Would you like? The first step, as I mentioned, towards sainthood is beatification. And José María de Escrivá was officially beatified in 1992. Now, things were going on in Spain in 1992. There was a big expo in Seville to commemorate 1492, okay, the events that happened then. One of the things that Spain did, much to its benefit ultimately, was to build a high-speed railway line, brand new, from Madrid to Seville. Standard gauge, high-speed trains, rather like the French TGV, which would gallop along at about 200 and a bit kilometres per hour and reduce the travelling time from Madrid to Seville to about 2.5 hours. Before that, it took pretty much all day to get there by rail. Remarkably good service, and it's something that's being expanded throughout Spain now. This high-speed railway line was initially called the TAVE, T-A-V-E, which meant train, de alta velocidad, of high speed, and then E stood for Español, the Spanish high-speed train. And then when Monsignor Escrivá was beatified, it was a rather rapid process which was rushed through, and he became known locally in Spain as El Bave, that is, the Beato de Alta Velocidad Español, the high-speed Spanish Beatus. Okay. And another joke, okay? It used to be reckoned in Franco's day that if you wanted to achieve any sort of high position in the civil service, or particularly in universities, you had to be a member of this Opus Dei. It was the sort of the old boys' club, if you like, which guaranteed that you'd be looked on with favour by the government and by university hiring authorities. Now, the process in Spain for getting a full professorship in a university is a sort of public competition where candidates for a position go through a process which they call in Spain oppositions, oposiciones. And basically what they have to do is stand up and give a presentation and be questioned by a general public audience. And then after, say, five candidates have done their thing, a choice will be made based on various levels. One of the issues being whether or not you're a member of the Opus Dei, I guess. Now, the process of going through oppositions in Spain is the verb to do it is opositar. Okay. Now, it became a sort of saying that si no opositas, if you don't opposite, si no opusitas, that is, if you're not a member of the opus, then no opositas, then you don't opposite. Okay, you don't do this, you're not allowed to get anywhere. Okay, end of jokes, not very funny.
Academic jokes.
Yeah. And yet, you know, thinking about it, when all is said and done, if I can ask you, that is either collectively or individually, to say a prayer for me, why can't I do the same to someone who has gone before us and who is nearer to our God than I am? On which point I leave questions to you. Okay, thank you.